Okay, what we have here is board time, 19 November at 2:49. So, Chris Cook, Children's
Hope
Society.
Yeah, good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm here to request your authorization for Vanessa Gaston of Community Services to sign a settlement agreement with the Children's Home Society. I've been before you previously to discuss the issue that we had regarding overpayment by the Children's Home Society of respite care amounts, and you had, I believe, agreed with their offer to pay $23,278.84. They've signed the contract that would obligate them to pay that in installments of $2,500 monthly and then one leftover chunk until it's paid off. So it'll be all paid off by, I believe, the end of next August.
Good work. I think it sounds great with me.
I have the greatest confidence in Vanessa Gaston. If she's good with it and you're good with it, I'm good with it.
I recommend
start
that.
Off with three, I think. Three people that were overpaid, three groups that were overpaid.
Four.
And this is our last one?
This is not the last one, but we are down to one. So we have taken care of three now. So if I could have a vote, please, that would take care of it.
All those in favor?
The motion is how much?
$23,284.78. Does that sound right?
$278.84.
Makes
you wonder how they got that 84,
doesn't it? That's a settlement for the Children's Home Society to pay back
the Department of Community Services.
Department of Community
Services. Is there a time?
Okay.
What time?
All right.
$2,500.
They'll be
$2,500 in 1 month.
They'll be paying
paid by August 30th.
Installments.
Okay. All right.
How many years?
Less than a year.
By August 30th of next year.
Wow.
Okay. I move that we authorize and accept the settlement for Children's Home Society to pay back to the Department of Community Services the $23,278.84 payable in $2,500 monthly increments and whatever is left over at the end.
Seconded.
The moving seconder to accept the offer settlement. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Indeed.
We got two. Two of those.
And
huh?
thank Vanessa for a job well done.
I shall do that.
Yes.
Okay. Next is one of our favorite subjects we've talked about repeatedly over the last 6 or 8 months. So, Commissioner Barnes, you have repeatedly asked our good treasurer to come and talk to us about how he auctions off surplus properties, and so he is here today to do that.
Well, we auction off properties that are subject to tax foreclosure and or have gone beyond that. The properties that we we're selling, I guess you call it liens. I mean, there's a lien on the property for taxes. We're selling the taxes to pay off not only the county, but all the taxing districts. So the county is about 20% of the collections for that, plus our foreclosure costs. That money is then distributed to all the taxing districts. We start off with quite a few thousand at the beginning of the year and work our way down to where we sell about 12 properties a year. And a lot of it, the properties, the reasons why we sell them is because of legal description issues. There can be just the value of the property that people just don't want. And sometimes the county gets stuck with them. And so the county has a lot of tax title property. Maybe I could just, you know, if there are questions that you have, we do it on an annual basis.
Well, I think, Doug, I think some of the questions from some of the board members is that there's been some properties been sold more than one time, mm-hmm. and that nobody's doing the due diligence to let whoever the buyer beware to buy the property and then find out that they can't build a house on it, they can't do this on it, they can't do that on it, and then coming in here and complaining to the commissioners or to somebody mm-hmm. that the county stuck it to them. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to do is find out what mechanism you use in order to put online or the information that you give to when you have the auction so that everybody is aware of what the property is and what they can do and what they can't do with it. And I think David's got questions on this.
Well, our job is to sell the property. We find out if there are any liens on it by doing a title search, and that's at the point of where we sort of end. Now, if the EPA, or I should say Department of Ecology, says, well, there was a gas station on that piece of property, and we've had sometimes that turnover two or three times. People find out that there's more to clean up there than they bargained for and have let it just go. But eventually, in this one particular example, it was eventually purchased, and Department of Ecology felt that the plume of that was had leaked from the had stopped, and they were able to clean it up. So it sort of depends on the situation. Each property is different, and I don't have any control over land use issues. Those are all with the board and with the cities. Because I mean, when I talk countywide, you know, we got to have over half our properties in a city, you know, so that we're foreclosing on. So.
So everybody knows that when you put it up on the board for.
We sell as is, and it's people have the opportunity to do the research. We do have people that have come in at the last second to buy something because they just have the impulse to buy it because there is it's a potential real good deal. I remember one time a lady went out there, thought she did due diligence. She looked at the piece of property and saw that there was a house on it, and she bid on it and was real happy. She came down to our office to pay it, and we said, "Okay, well, it's good, but you didn't buy the house that was in the Minnehaha area. You bought actually a piece of property out in north of Hawkinson, and that she didn't realize that what she looked at was the mailing address of where we were sending." The statement and not the actual property, which was listed there. But I think, you know, she came in. She was the very last person to sign in. Came in, it was on the last property, and she just wanted to bid it. And she didn't really have a chance to. Evidently, she had the chance to get on the computer to see.
Doug, what are your responsibilities by state law and county codes required to do in order to put the properties up for auction?
By state law, once the property is 3 years delinquent, we commence a process of filing a certificate of delinquency, going before the court. The court orders us to sell the property, and it's pretty cut and dry. And then
do we place a lien on it and then foreclose?
Liens are automatically placed on all properties every year on January 1st it by state law. So the liens are there for the taxes to pay for government.
So including my property.
Everybody's property. But it's not, what do you call them?
It's not a lien that's filed in court.
Yeah, it's by statute.
By statute.
Yeah, it just happens. It's like
do we call it a statutory action?
A statutory lien.
A statutory lien.
Yes.
Chris, you had some information you were going to share.
By that.
Well, I was just
I told the board had asked me what could be done, and certainly there are a lot of things that the county does in its reviewing and its regulatory capacity that we review in terms of determining how properties do or don't comply with platting and do or don't comply with zoning. And so in terms of what the options are, there's certainly a number of options available for the board. The problem becomes when a parcel is foreclosed upon, when somebody doesn't find their property valuable enough to pay their taxes, and very frequently they may own the adjacent piece, so sometimes they're absentee landlords or absentee owners, but very frequently they're local owners. That to try and anticipate what possible use somebody who's bidding on this wants to make use of the property for is an exercise in guesswork. And so whether they want to use it for a business purpose or a parking lot, we have one commercial owner out in Salmon Creek who wants to buy land that's currently zoned medium density residential for a commercial parking lot for his business. You really don't know. The other issues become this question of compliance with platting and zoning, and those are legitimate issues. But the treasurer is not an owner of the property. He never becomes the owner. He just holds this statutory lien that he's under a state law obligation to foreclose upon to collect the money that is due the taxing districts, both Clark County and the junior tax districts.
And the state.
And the state. So there are a number of things that probably can be done. When I look at 8464200 that talks about the cost that the treasurer can recoup, I'm not sure that this is a legitimate cost that you could recoup. So if you imposed an obligation for doing research on parcels before they went to foreclosure, I'm not sure that we could ultimately recoup that from the successful bidder. You may be able to. There's no case that's cited with this that helps answer that question, but certainly there is a lot of risk that we take on, because the courts have said where you don't have an obligation to do something, you may create an obligation by going farther than you need to. And once you go down that path, you have to act reasonably. And that's going to be up to somebody else to decide whether or not you went far enough, even though you didn't have to do anything in the first place. And so there's a real risk that the board takes on if you start marching down this path, and so that's the area for concern. It's easy to say in one particular case that we could have done something. The case that I think you're referring to, if I remember correct, sure. It's out in Ridgefield, out by 31st or 41st, that's an old, that there was a fuel contamination, and it kept turning around to subsequent sellers. But we've had this happen in other occasions. By and large, we don't know what people do with their property, and a lot of the properties that we buy, because Doug's probably in a better position than I to tell you, they're slivers of pieces. They're leftover pieces from government purchases. Well, not so much government purchases, but they can be any number of things, but they're often very unbuildable, and they serve no purpose other than they're often sold to the adjoining properties.
But once you do this for one piece of property, and in the future you're going to be obligated to do it for every piece of property.
Well, certainly that creates that issue. I mean, we would argue on your behalf that that you're not, but that's why I said a court is going to say that while you don't have an obligation to do something, once you take it on, they're going to expect you to act reasonably, and you're creating a risk where none exists right now.
And for us, in terms of what our job is to, we want to attract, we want to keep that property on the tax roll, and we want to make sure we're not adding more cost to it, that these properties that are marginal, no one's going to be bidding on it. So if you add these
Search costs.
costs into that because, and it's not our office that would do that because we don't have, it's
that
your,
would be the assessor's office.
No, it'd be your
no,
offices. It'd be your employees that would have to be looking this up and giving us the information. But, as I said before, every day or every week there could be properties paid off. So, it may be that you'd be spending a lot of energy looking up for stuff that's only 12 properties at the end. And we don't know until 5 o'clock that night, the day before the sale, what properties are going to be remaining.
Because
so,
they have until that time to pay.
Yeah, because they have
a right of redemption.
Right. So, you know, the questions also I would have is, I mean, we do a tax foreclosure, but the sheriff also does sales too. So would you put it on those sales? Would you know, there are questions of when is the timing to provide some information that could be additional information. But from our perspective, why do we spend counties and taxpayers' money for something that someone is going to be speculating on and looking at it? Why should we be engaged?
You know, after having done it for 29 years, not all the buyers that come, but some of the buyers that come have just gone to a class that some person's taught on how to get rich quick.
Or they stay up late at night watching.
And it's how you go about buying
in my free seminar.
And that's what worries me is that we're going to start showing, we're going to start giving more information out about something that really, Doug's right, they're just speculating on. They're thinking they're going to make a quick buck.
Some have and some haven't.
You know, yes, I had a realtor every time I bought a house, helped me look through all of this stuff, but nobody in the county helped.
So let me tell you where we're coming from on this. We get the complaints. We get the complaints, whether it be it goes right down from one commissioner to the next, and until they think they get satisfied, they get no satisfaction at all. And one of the things that we were concerned about is that we didn't want to just say as is, where is, you know that's one aspect. But we found that we're selling the same piece of property over and over and over again.
Actually, we haven't sold a lot of parcels.
No,
over
I can only remember two.
Several.
We had to sell the Darby property over three times.
I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that at all.
But actually, what generally happens is if it goes all the way, and Doug, or we do it online now, if it doesn't sell, it goes to the county. The county owns it.
I'm not there. Where I'm coming from is that we are employees of the general public, and we need to provide a service. And when we just want to wash our hands of it, that I don't think is responsible on our part, as we represent the citizens. And we want to do everything that we can.
Remember,
so that they
we're trying to represent. We're talking about maybe 100 people coming in out of the 450.
Yeah, I represent them too. So maybe let me finish.
Yeah.
So, when you go to a sheriff's sale, you see what you're buying.
It'll
be a junk car,
you see a piece of paper.
A row of guns, or whatever. I've been there.
We're talking about the
properties.
No, so properties. They sell downstairs.
I know. I'm not getting that.
Okay.
But when apparently we sell a lot on the online, and someone sells something down here. I think that we need to do a little bit more. You've already said you do a title search. And it wouldn't be that much more to find out if it's a piece of parcel of land. And what's deceiving is that we'll have a parcel of land 1 to 6 acres in size. And everybody assumes that that is a home site, but it's not necessarily so. And so they will buy that piece of property and think they're going to build a home on it. And it'd be simple to look into our computers and see that that's not a buildable piece of land. Or in this case here where you said that you had a gas station, that we were aware of the gas plume pollution underneath it.
And we told them about that because that was in the time.
That's where I'm going. Yeah. Just disclose something in good faith that we know, but limit what, how far we go.
Oh, we do.
I just want to do something a little bit more to represent the people to where that in good faith that we try to provide an honest offering that they understand what they're going to buy. Now, we also have lots of leftover parcels of roads and slivers and things, and we're working on that right now, too, to sell or give it to a joint property owner, something to get us out from underneath that responsibility of the unbuildable land, but it could go someplace else. But likewise, on this other side, it'd be nice to sell it just once, knowing it's not going to come back, but it was something that the people were aware of, and to the best of our ability that we disclosed that. And that's where we're trying to go. And we don't know how much time, how much effort that we should put into it. And I know that most of the costs that we do in foreclosures or anything else is tacked onto that. I remember Mr. Teeters, Garcia was clear of around $300,000 penalties, and I think that was probably from code enforcement. I think
that wouldn't be honest.
But that was on its way. That was headed toward taking over and selling that piece of property before he died. So that's kind of where we're trying to go. We're just trying to get someplace to where we could agree to what we disclose, how much effort we put into it, and that kind of thing. And that's kind of where we were, and we're asking you to be here and share something.
Is there a response for that?
Well, for us, I mean, if there's something I notice that's out there by the Department of Ecology, it's usually in a title report, and or there someone has contacted us on that. I mean, we have the information out there. Your staff could look at it and say something.
One reason to use the title report is to determine whether or not a city has a lien against it.
Mm-hmm. It could be a labor lien, it could be a tax lien,
but really it's an assessment or something like that.
Yeah.
We're required to collect those too, okay? But we also find out that there's federal tax liens on it. We're not collecting that. And it's going to stay against the property. But the title report shows that. Everybody has the right to ask for that title report and we'll share it with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly believe that's about as far as I want to go with it.
Well, I wanted to bring up, I guess, two points that Doug and I have talked about before that may play into this. And that's, first of all, that all of the information that the county, that whoever does this, would do this, all that information is available online to the person that is purchasing the property. And that person is aided, as Chris alluded to, by an understanding of what they want to do with the property, as opposed to it's more of a speculation on our part about what they may or may not want to do.
Let me ask you a question there, yeah. Mike Taylor. When you say it's online, is it the information that we put there, or is it other information that they could...
All on GIS is the information that we would be, my understanding, yes. Is the information that the county would be drawing from to reach any sort of conclusion about what this property may or may not be good for. But the county, in addition to relying on that public information, would also be having to speculate about what that person's intended purpose for the property was.
So all the information is there, whether they look at it.
Whether or not you know how to look for it all.
What we don't want to do is do something that implies warranty or somehow adds liability or expectation or anything like that. I assume that whatever process going forward, that we would always say all property is sold as is, no warranties, that the title report is always available to them. And I would assume that would be part of the package.
I think it's
and the extra step that we could potentially take would be a checkbox that would say this property is known not buildable. If this is not checked, then the buildability of this property is not disclosed. So all this is an extra checkbox that says If it's not checked, that it's not being disclosed. If it is checked, it's known not buildable.
Then I would want the community development department to put that box there. The treasurer's office, I don't believe you should put it.
Regardless of who does it, is that...
But if the block isn't checked...
Then it's not disclosed.
It's implied that it is buildable.
It's stated that it's not disclosed.
That's electricity.
Is that adequate, Chris?
It depends how you write it. The issue can haunt you both ways. If you say it's not buildable and it turns out it is, and you, in property, let's say we say it's not buildable.
For at least one reason.
For one, we name a reason. It's not in compliance with current zoning. Mm-hmm. So, but it turns out that because historically it was divided back in 1940, and it may have the ability, had they gone and gotten a legal lot determination, to be buildable, there may well be a claim from the property, because it didn't sell for as much as it should have, that we're liable to the person who was foreclosed upon because the property could have sold for more. So this argument can come back to haunt you even in the best of circumstances. Now, we can try and write it to mitigate those risks, but it's something of a dangerous area because platting and zoning is kind of complicated, and there are a number of issues you wind up asking.
In many ways, I
think the other thing is too, Chris. If you did that, and somebody wanted to buy that piece of property, and you put that on there, and the person bypassed the property and found out that somebody else got it, they would turn around and sue the county because they thought that you cut a deal with somebody else to take that property that they should have had the opportunity to buy. I think you're opening Pandora's box.
If the board wants to do something, remember, all of this is a little bit easier if it's in the county's system. If it's in the cities, we're going to have to struggle. We're going to have more effort to get access to their online facilities to be able to check out information, and assuming it's all up to date. But so it gets more complicated if you're dealing with Vancouver, Ridgefield, Le Center, all those areas.
And they may not
want to participate. But if you want to keep it factual, if you do it just factual, for example, this property doesn't meet current zoning. Well, that should be pretty easy to determine. There's 5 acres,
that's
the
good.
Zoning's 10. Mm-hmm. You can say it doesn't meet current zoning. It seems to me you're probably less likely to have a problem with that kind of a simple statement.
Yes.
But again, that's only really an available option in the county.
Yeah.
Not all the all the cities have those maps online.
Good. So the natural way this would work is that you normally wouldn't check any of those boxes, and which means it defaults to nothing is disclosed. It's all sold as is, and it's always also sold as is. The discretion that this provides. When we know, and it's so obvious to us that this is the third time this thing's going to sale, because we know absolutely it's not buildable, at that point, then you can say, by the way, pay attention to this, because we know that one's not buildable. So it's an exception to handle those exceptional cases that will end up coming back with somebody who think they got a really good deal, and we hear from again. It happened again because we didn't do anything to prevent it from a continual repeat. So you would never check that box unless it's an exceptional case and say, we already know this one's not buildable. Don't fall for it.
What? Yeah. My view is we'd never check it anyway. The community development would check it.
Right. When I say we, the county. Yeah.
So I'm thinking along that line also that what does it take to determine legal lot? Is it complicated? I don't know.
It can be very. I spent 4.5 hours doing one all by myself because it dealt with a particular developer's property. Mm-hmm. But it's anywhere from, because you have to review the sales history, and it can take anywhere from 2 to 6 hours for each one.
I have a question. What happens if someone buys a piece of property and it looks buildable, but then the commissioners do some changes with the zoning or growth management or whatever down the road, and now it becomes non-buildable?
The county code has had since about 1980 a provision in which we grandfather historic parcels that were created at a time when they were in compliance with zoning but because of changes, either due to growth management or other reasons, that they no longer comply. So we may limit the uses for which property can be placed, but we provide grandfathering to a large extent for previously created pieces.
So if they had property that's subject to wetland, they could still go ahead and build there. Mm-hmm.
There may be restrictions on that, but they don't lose the ability to construct.
So maybe forget about the buildable for a minute. The idea of just simply what's obvious to us, to everyone, without doing any significant research at all, is the ability for us to check the box that says this property does not comply with current zoning. We can say that easily, right?
Pretty broad.
For county property.
Yeah, for county property.
But then what additional liability do we bring to ourselves because we didn't disclose it on
No,
the
no, we don't, because the rest of it says we're not disclosing.
We still, as is where he is, but we want to disclose as a service. But I'm concerned with, like Chris says, I don't expect us to get into 2 to 6 hours worth of work on a piece of property to sell it. And then, like you said, there could be a complexity. If it's in the city, we're looking for some way to limit liability and still provide a little bit better service to the citizens.
I have a suggestion. Mm-hmm. If the goal is to avoid those repeat scenarios, mm-hmm. the disclosure doesn't have to necessarily be as specific as known not buildable or known current zoning. The disclosure for this limited number of parcels at the end could be as simple as
history.
The last date that this was the second foreclosure in 5 years,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
As opposed to a more specific representation. And then it's mm-hmm. everyone's on notice.
That's a good idea. In other words, disclose the sales history of the property.
Which is arguably already.
It's already on the
internet. On GIS.
Yeah, it's at the Property Information Center, right? Yeah,
everything's out there.
But that would be a little bit more of a objective, mm-hmm. factual representation.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
As opposed to a warranty of any specific thing. Yeah.
So if they want to go research through GIS to do that, which requires a little bit of skill on their part, it's available.
They're about to spend like $30,000, so it's not a...
Yeah. And the other part is for us just simply... To include that as part of the documentation that goes with it, handed in paper. There it is right there. They don't have to go search for it. It's because it's really quick and easy for us to be able to include that as the information with the property.
Well, online. I mean, this would be an online...
Well, when you go to the online bid site, the properties are listed. You click on a property and...
There it is.
I'd like to use this. I assume that a page pops up with all the relevant information about that parcel. Is that right or not?
That's true. I currently wouldn't go tell you what maps to search.
It will point you to the PIC site, Property Information Center site, and then you got to go there for further information. Go to this website.
If we did that, I think that might disclose what we're looking for, you think?
Anybody can, most all that detail can be found by somebody.
Everything is out there.
As soon as they get into the PIC site, it'll tell them what the zoning is, when it was last sold, how much the property taxes are. Well, it may not provide that to the public. Does it? Okay, it tells
everything.
What the property taxes are that are owed. It will tell them, you can look up whether or not, how much of the property is in wetland, whether or not it's subject to critical area aquifer. All that's available.
Would it tell them, though, that it was a tax lot created by the assessor? And
no.
That that is might be in the right zone, but it's landlocked, and it's not a real sellable lot.
You'd have to look at the property. The legal description...
That's the warranty I'm afraid we'll get into.
Yeah, we can't. I mean, this board, I assume, doesn't want to get in the business of talking about whether property is accessible or landlocked or not otherwise.
No. I think it's legal lock because I'm getting more and more on a daily basis of parcels of land that we're finding today that are not... legal lots.
But they're a tax lot, and the assessor has the right to create these tax lots by just doing it.
Yeah, they can create them in 2 inches.
I'm off the top of my head, there's a 6-acre piece that has been created right alongside the road, but because of the zoning and the way it got cut up, we end up with 6 acres out there. You go and go out there and plant a garden.
To me, it seemed like it would be simpler, even whether you put it online or if a person walked into the treasurer's office to pick up a bid document to bid on a piece of property, that person would sign a piece of paper saying that he received the following information on that property and has reviewed it. He would have to sign off on that, whether he clicks on the television screen or the screen or whatever screen it is to say that he has picked the information up, he's got a copy of it, he understands what it is, and that. And rather than just have them go online and say, click, I got the information, that who knows
who's
clicking.
They can't even get to the information until they do
read
the disclaimers.
It's not about covering their butt.
They have to sign off on it before they get the information. If they don't sign off, then
what can we provide simple, just to give someone a heads up, as a service, not a responsibility or liability or something like that. I'm not looking to say, I got you. You know, you didn't look, so I get to sell it again. We don't need that. And like I said, it's not a single little piece of property. I got 6 acre lots out there that are misplotted that cannot be built on. And because it's so far out there, I got a 6 acre piece of property could never be built on and could never be taxed.
Can't you come to the board and get, what do you call a waiver? No, not.
On this one piece of property.
Not if it doesn't comply with zoning currently.
I thought you got a variance.
Well, you can apply for a variance, but the standards are not insignificant. And just generally speaking, that's not an available option.
Unsuspecting
buyer. If we're talking about a small amount of land, maybe, but not if you're talking about 6 versus 20. If it's a 20-acre zone and this is a 6-acre piece, you're not going to get a zoning variance for that.
And those are the ones we're starting to run into as people are looking at what to build and.
What the board has to, I mean, the complexity of this, what we're starting to see is this is not just innocent. I mean, I have to tell you that we're seeing developers and realtors even who are doing this intentionally because there's a lot of money to be made selling illegal property, illegally divided property, and I've actually had to go to the point of threatening to prosecute somebody to get them to stop. Because they can take a $20,000 piece of property and sell it for $100,000 if they call it a legal lot.
Yeah.
And they're gone by the time the buyer comes in to complain about, I can't get a building permit.
Yeah.
And we've got you have to be aware these are out there.
Taylor's recommendation sounds like a good one. The question is the sales history of a particular parcel easily available online?
Yes. If it has been sold in the recent past, yes. If they're older, the answer is generally not. I don't think you guys go back very far, 5 years.
Those aren't really the scenarios. But
yeah.
So, in other words, it is available. The question is, if it's available, do we make it conveniently available? For instance, the way that we offer the property, we list, whatever, when they go there, can they click and there is the parcel on the GIS with the information?
Yes.
Or do they say, here's the tax ID number, there's the site, go plug in the stuff and make sure you get it just right, so you navigate to it. Do we say, here's the link, there's the property?
You know, I probably should have had staff in here that just did the demo of what the software does.
You know, Doug, with that being said, I don't think we're going to resolve this, it sounds like, right now. So I'd like to suggest that we all go back and put on our thinking caps and come back at another time. And see if we come up with ideas, because it sounds more complicated. It's just not that simple, I guess.
Well, what I would suggest at this point, and I expect on agreement, correct me if we're not, is that whatever is available out there, that one step we can take is to make sure that when they click on a property, when the information, they go to wherever the auction information is, that it, we make it quick and convenient to go to the sales history, the rest of that information, without having to somehow navigate there and through a convoluted multi-step process.
So is that in our IT department?
Well, if you have six...
Are we already doing
we
that?
We have a vendor that we work with to do the online, the auction. So
yes.
We're going to have to communicate with the vendor and see if that's possible.
And then it links in back into the PIC.
So if we're not doing that, we can ask them to do that, or at least say, give us a proposal. can you include that? Because that just provides better disclosure.
I have to say that.
I would say in the case of Doug said he had six parcels the last time, maybe in order for Tom and David and Jeannie to see what's going on, maybe what you ought to do is send that information to each one of these commissioners so they flip it up on their screen and look at it themselves.
Right. Yes. You just can't bid on it.
Well, they can't bid on it. I think they could probably get somebody to bid on it too, if they wanted to.
Hard knocks.
But I would say send them the information so they see just exactly what has been disclosed on those six chunks of property so that they know that you guys aren't, you know, doing something like some of these people that Chris was talking about that sell the property for $100,000.
I just don't want them to get on a kiss of violating the law.
I don't think they're violating the law. They have the right, to look.
Tax property tax and the fees. Yeah. If it sells for more than that, owner,
the property owner, gets the excess.
So
we're not selling.
I understand that. I understand
the so the only question here is there a smarter way to do this that serves everybody better, that doesn't make a lot of work for us, that makes it more convenient? And if there is, then we ought to find out if we can do it. If there isn't, then what we got is, you know, is the best we can do.
And one thing that I know all the departments do, and we do, is constantly looking at ways, because people come at it from different angles, and we're trying to make life, when you go on the internet or come in or off, easier for people to understand.
Make life easy for the customer.
But there is a case of, there are some people who just, it just won't click for them. Period, and we can't.
Don't talk about me. We talk about computers and me. I can tell.
We can chase whether people do due diligence or just or on it. So I don't want to get to the point where we're trying to get 99.99% because we'll never get that point. But we do always try to look at ways and we'll explore if there's something more. I know that we had some discussion about the verbiage. And that we had on there for people to check off that they had read everything and understand what's doing. But the Jeffersons, they said they were quick.
We're just not going to talk about that one.
Yeah.
So go on.
Nothing specific.
Okay.
So if there's reasonable room for improvement and what we just and how we provide the information, let's pursue it. And it's reasonable and it's not anything extreme. That's
true. Right. There was a whole lot of conversation floating around here, and I wanted the rest of the board members, including me, to understand better what the treasurer was doing so that the rumors either.
And we're still not sure what he does.
Yeah.
Well, come on down.
Come on down. He'll show you.
One point I'd like to make is on your real property tax foreclosure auction process page. You say that the legal public notice will be published in the Columbian, the local newspaper. Our legal paper of record is the Reflector.
We'll add the Reflector to that, but we have to do the Columbian also.
Why?
Because by state law, we have to do
large the circulation.
Larger circulation, the general circulation, because the Reflector doesn't come down to Vancouver, it doesn't come down to Camas. And other areas that we have properties for foreclosure. So we do both. So we pay for both. So or that actually the people who buy the property pay for it. So but we have to upfront the cost.
Paper of record is the Reflector.
Yeah, we do both.
That's where all of our notices go to.
Right, but I have state law that I have to abide by.
No, that's not what it is.
I'd like to just point something out. We had a discussion on this probably 6 months ago. This discussion we're having today is almost a duplicate of that. And so the concerns were only the properties that were repeat sales. Mm-hmm. And they got thrown back up after they were sold, and they got thrown back up.
There were
a few of those. But, you know, I come from the corporate world, and I find that there's never a better substitute for a good tutorial. So if you're trying to make a decision about what you should do, you should definitely know what's already there. Mm-hmm. And so it would be great if each one of the commissioners making this decision would have an individual tutorial, mm-hmm. as if they were the person going in, so they can see. And maybe you might discover that there's already language in there that says stop, wait, red flags. Everybody is responsible for doing their own due diligence. If it's not there, you might want to say, this is how we should be doing this.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
good. Good. Thank you, everybody, for coming. I know that it's a work in progress. I'm not sure if we're ever going to be able to do it, but we want to try it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, we won't get the 100%.
I know.
Okay, I've got it.
I'm going to have to have someone come and help me on my computer. I know how to get to the Clark County website.
We'll do a, we could do an October 20 showing just to go through this. That are land only, but we're just talking about land.
What about the gazebo? What is that?
That is, those are private sales. That's the title companies, the banks, the sheriff sales. They do that there, and we deal with. Is this thing on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are people who are professional about that, that are important in this whole process. I'll just say food chain for an example.
There
are fellows that are all the boards. I mean, this is what they do.
To figure out which ones report to commissioners, which ones report to staff.
They got a lot of cash.
The reality is, it's
and they know what they do.
To different mm-hmm. people,
and they usually take the ones that are
reports to the commissioners once a year.
They could make a
report. Is it something they really
silk purse out of a sow's ear?
So is it actually
and so there's
houses?
What a lot. Or
it could be a combination of both. But a lot of the stuff that we have is
which ones they want to
strips of property about as wide as this room.
Yes.
Or hillsides next to the road. I saw a lot of the county is practically getting all the hillsides. So hopefully there's no slides that go down for the property. Hopefully the county is making sure that
we've been after those to try to get one of the adjoining property owners to reduce our maintenance and liability.
Work closely so we make sure we collect the taxes if it's tax title property, if not. But yeah, in some ways, I have these strips that are very narrow behind four homes because the guys, it's legal description, they didn't plot the fences right. Yeah. I tried to go to the neighbors and say, do you want your property? No. I have access to this county.
I know.
But somehow, we got almost like, and I can't see a gift of funds. Because we're holding this in trust for everybody else, so the taxes are still out there that are owed, but somehow we've got to get that to that property owner.
They call us up and tell us to come and mow it.
Keep salmon.
Yeah, it's not down for enough.
There we go.
Blackberry's out of there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely want to check in with she's got.
Liable to jump out of there.
Well, that was a good effort. I think it's something we've learned, so we know more now than what we did when we started. I think there's still possibilities of searching for things that we can do on a simple basis to improve service to the people of Clark County, and that's our goal.
Okay. Next is advisory boards and commissions. I think there are two pieces to this. One is getting us through the end of the year, and that's what Axel's going to talk about. And then Peter's been doing some other work that would be part two, and that's, I guess, after 1 January. How are we going to handle appointments to boards and commissions? So, Axel, your ball?
So like Mark said, I handed out a list. There's if you go about two-thirds of the way down, stop at the one with the animal control, 131-2015, draw a line there. I think the most pressing thing is just that Jennifer wanted me to get some clarification from the full board because I think she's been working with you guys individually. We've been running pretty smoothly. What you had decided before was throw everything out to advertisement regardless of incumbents, get all the applications, create the binders, schedule the interviews, and we've kind of been marching forward. We've got kind of a logjam here, you can see, of vacancies coming up before the first of the year, and I think she's looking for just some as clear as we can get direction on. All these have been advertised, but do you want to interview for all of them? And that may require us to kind of go through each of the advisory boards and have you tell me, and I'll tell her, or we'll tell her, yes, no, on which ones of these you want to either just go ahead with the incumbent, or just make a selection out of the binder, or actually do interviews. Anna's worked on this in the past. I'm glad she's here. She can chime in, and then Peter's doing some stuff on kind of the future.
So let me share actually where we came from as a board. There were some things that we were and some things that we weren't. But what's more important is that if it's an advisory committee, should all advisory committees or commissions come to the policymakers, and that is the Board of Commissioners. So another concern that we had is that how many staff do we have working on each one of these? What hours do they meet? What is their function? I don't see where an advisory board going directly to the department is necessarily in the direction of the policy makers. So, and then the other thing I thought, there's a lot of these that never come to the board for an annual report or anything else. What are we doing for those? Why are we involved? It's just a pot of money we're spending out here on these, and so we don't know a lot of this stuff.
And the answers to those questions are difficult without going through them individually and talking about their mission, what service they provide, what recommendations they provide to which department, and why. And I think we're going to have that conversation. Peter started doing some work on that already, moving forward. I guess the primary question, though, is between now and the end of the year, the clear direction I thought for staff is, you want all of them advertised, every vacancy, regardless of, you know, the interest of the incumbent, and you want to go through those binders with all the applications and interview and select for each position. I think that's changed a little bit, at least.
No, it hasn't.
Has it changed?
And I'll tell you why. The incumbents we have come in, and they share a light on a lot of things that have been working and have not been working. So with that, we can give direction to that advisory board or to that department as to something that they could do better or do differently to make that board more functional for the members that sit on it. That's how we got there. And what happened when we tried to split the requirements from one to the other, it got confusing. And some of those that we should have been interviewing wasn't getting interviewed. So I think they all need to come to the board. We need to know what their function are, who they report to, what is the mission and what is the goal.
This discussion has been had so many times, and months ago, the board tried to give clear. There's two different discussions going on here. Mm-hmm. The first discussion is about what the clear policy is of how you pick and choose an interview. And you put I typed up for you, and you signed, and we gave to Mark, a six-point bullet point, very simple procedure that the board wanted. They wanted to make sure that the advertising was done in plenty of time, so you're not up against a deadline. They want to make sure that it was always advertised. They want to make sure that it was advertised in Reflector and the PIO to make a call to the Reflector if it was very important that we get, so that we get some kind of good response. You wanted to have the option of, if you only get a couple of responses, of instructing the staff to go out and re-advertise it. And you wanted to make sure that all of the incumbents got an interview out of respect for them, but not necessarily that they would be chosen, and that every single person, including incumbents, were to provide some kind of a resume, some kind of a background, something that you could choose from. And that was set in policy here in this boardroom, and that was put in a bullet point and given out. You signed it. That was months ago.
Mm-hmm.
So
September.
I don't understand. I see these emails flowing back and forth with all this confusion. Mm-hmm. Do you want to interview? Do you want to just point? Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that?
We have people requesting exceptions, department directors who say, why should I have to do that?
Well, because the board said they have to do it.
Exactly.
And so they, and that helps Jennifer understand, regardless of somebody coming back and saying, for just the other day, for instance, she had a one-liner. I want to be reappointed to this board. I'm an incumbent, and I think I've got some good ideas. Well, he was late getting it in. Repeatedly, she asked him to provide her with his background like everybody else. He refused to do that, and so he didn't meet the qualifications. So, you know, it's if that part of it, if you keep it fairly rigid and fairly consistent, everybody knows how the game's played, then everybody will do that, and it'll be easy for the staff.
Yeah. Our goal is that we want to understand their mission and their goal and their function. I think we need to go back and see how much staff time is being spent on these and if they're being useful. Mm-hmm. We also are open to people recommending or recommendations. For example, if I have the chair of the railroad board and they think Joe Smith is a very good person, they'd like to recommend this person, and then comes through on an application.
Yeah, and that's all in your binders.
Yeah.
They provide that in the binders. They'll say the this particular board recommends these two folks.
Or like the deep board, they'll come back and say, okay, I'm looking for an engineer, or I'm looking for a developer. Yeah. And then we can lean in that direction with what they need on that board.
So that's one part of the discussion. The other part of the discussion that you're alluding to is a different discussion, and that's what service do they provide, why don't they, do they advise the board directly, if they're not, why aren't they, why do we never hear from them, those kinds of discussions. That's part of the discussion.
Yeah. So the standardized, simple, well-defined process includes identifying up front there's going to be a need, advertising for it, making a folder, a notebook that includes everything, including any recommendations, letters that go in there.
Bylaws.
They get, the bylaws as to geography, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Everybody has an address. They all get those notebooks get distributed to the commissioners. The commissioners at that point will determine whether or not they're interested to interview any of them, or all of them, or some of them, and the process flows from there. Want to make sure that there's clarity. That not because of the interview, not everybody gets interviewed. That decision is made based upon what we get in the notebook. And we can say, yeah, there's three openings, there's three good candidates. Green
same,
light.
Same three.
Yeah,
just
same
like
three.
In football, you get your draft picks.
Yeah. So all this does is it allows the discretion, all the information, for us to be able to say whether or not we want to interview some or all or none of them, and just or appoint them. So the process for the county staff here, very clearly defined. Mm-hmm. No question, no ambiguity there. What's not to like?
And then that all changes in January.
Any questions, Axel?
No. So and to Jennifer's credit, she has continued to do that. So I want that to be clear.
She was getting mixed messages.
She's advertising. She's putting these things in a binder for you. What she's anticipated is that you want to continue with that process. Mm-hmm. She has gotten some pushback from the staff of some of the advisory committees about, are interviews going to be done? Can we do them? How should we proceed? So that's kind of how this bubbled back up.
Yeah.
It's certainly whoever wants to participate in the process ahead of us getting the notebooks, they're free to do so. This doesn't throttle anybody back. I want to make sure that whatever message gets communicated to the advisory board and to the staff or anybody involved, that there is no negative in there. It's not a thing where we control it all and you can't do anything. No, they can do as much as they want. But we also want to make sure that there's standardized process. And their input, if they want to participate, include that letter, that recommendation in the notebook as well.
Which they have been doing, because all of the notebooks, I would say about 80% of the notebooks that we get, that you folks get, has, Jennifer's doing a great job. She's tabbing it all,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, one it says
good.
Board recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
The board recommends these folks.
Mm-hmm.
She does.
For these
good
reasons.
Job.
Mm-hmm. So that part looks like we're all on the same page there.
Yeah,
that process is fine. Keep doing it.
Okay. So you have approximately 20 vacancies or 23 to fill by the end of the year?
You know, 11 different.
Mark is looking at this, knowing that down the road under the new charter.
I'm looking at section 3.3B, which says that the county manager appoints members of boards, commissions, and task forces except as provided by state law. Appointments by the county manager shall be presented to the council during a regular council meeting.
We put that in there.
Within 30 days, the council shall accept or reject the appointment by a majority vote. Failure to act within 30 days constitutes acceptance of the appointment.
It's a partnership.
Yeah, it's a recommendation and an approval.
That you get to do all the work on.
Lots of interviews.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting in this process, when I get the book from Jennifer, I've looked at some of those, the background in there, and the one that didn't want to put the background in there, yeah. That was an automatic for me to to
say. That's a veto power.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, there was people that put stuff in there that I thought that I never met before. But the comments that they made in there were so interesting mm-hmm. that I thought it would be worthwhile as a commissioner to interview that person.
And it's not a negative for the incumbent to be required to give a background or a resume. It's a positive for them so that they have an opportunity to let themselves shine to you mm-hmm. because you may have never heard them before.
Yeah. And I think David, on a couple of them that we interviewed, he asked them because they didn't put any educational background in there. He says, where's your educational background? What did you do to? But the basic resume that they wrote up was pretty good, but they didn't put anything in there how they got qualified to be on one of these super boards. Super boards, you know. So I just
experience.
All right.
So did you get what you needed there?
I'm good. I don't know.
Okay. Somewhere down the way, we'll probably delve into this a little bit more.
Yeah.
There's one more clarification, and that is that so that Jennifer's process is easy and well-defined and all, if there's any question as to process or anything like that, that she would go back to you, Mark, and help, and you would help her to sort that out rather than to each of us. She's got one boss, not four.
Four.
Yeah. Good point. So that settles us through the end of the year, so we are going to be doing a transition process here, and I'm looking at all the boards and assignments. You've requested information on, both of you have, on who do these actually provide advice to? Is it to the board? Is it to mm-hmm. staff? Is it to both?
Yeah.
And how useful is that to different people? People have a different idea of, well, like I said, the Youth Commission produces a report, but is that something the board really finds useful, or is it just something that the Youth Commission finds
and that's
useful
something
to send?
We need to find out more down the way. That's what I alluded to, and that is, what is their mission, and what is their goal?
Mm-hmm.
Are they just doing work for the department, or mm-hmm. for advisory policies? See, in the past, we've actually had departments having the board go out and promoting their agenda. Instead of being an advisory board, think of new ideas. Now, it's okay that in the past we've also had staff go back and say, look into this, 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 and this. And then that advisory board or commission would take a priority where they want to go with it.
So all of that should be on the on the advisory board grid.
And a lot of it is, and it's really easily accessible, so we can provide some summaries for that as well.
Yeah. And, you know, the Parks Advisory Board, for example, they meet with staff, and they discuss issues of the day. And, for example, the two items that were pulled off the consent hearing, staff put the policy documents together, put them on the consent agenda, and then had a Parks Advisory Board meeting, and the Parks Advisory Board wanted to tweak the language of those policies a little bit, so they were removed, and they'll be brought back.
Well, good.
So indirectly, they're advising the board.
Maybe we could meet with some quarterly, some every 6 months, some once a year. Mm-hmm. We get feedback from those boards that are positive and negative, and also mm-hmm. we need to be looking at staff time involved in these meetings. Are they all working at night? Is there anything during the daytime? Because we have flex time, and when we come to work, no one's here because they were all had functions the night before.
Okay.
All right.
And then, at what point do we want to start addressing how to transition and what you want?
I think
next year.
Yeah, that's part of the larger discussion tonight. I've got a recommendation I'm going to be making to the board on how to address the charter and how to begin to think about that transition.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, Commissioner report. Your last report.
Last report?
Yeah.
What was it?
Yep.
Well, I thought it was good till the end of the year.
You're reading the wrong RCW that I read.
Oh, did I? Oh. You get the right interpretation from the Attorney General, huh? Well, what I need to bring up, I'm going to bring up again. I think that I'm going to say again that I think that the Environmental Services needs to be back where it used to be 5 years ago. I'll put that out there. I think that the...
What kind of grounds are you doing that? Are you?
What kind of grounds?
Just Benton is I think keep bringing it up.
Well, Tom, like I told you before, and every time I look at the consent agenda, and I looked at it very carefully this last, you had 25 items on there. The items that come out of the Environmental Services area are basically pass-throughs that either go to the transportation or to development. They don't do anything other than, in my mind, other than do the paperwork. But the paperwork all ends up in Heath Henderson's lap or in Marty's lap, and they do the same thing over again. So for $750,000, that don't make good sense. So I think it needs to be looked at. I think that in my mind, and David, you guys always say you want smaller government, you want more efficient government, you want to save the taxpayer some money.
You're listening.
We can do away with solid waste.
What you're saying, man. I'm listening to that old lady that you talked to out there
Grandma.
When you were going through there saying she didn't want her taxes raised. I'm trying to get her taxes lowered by saving her $750,000, David. So I'm just telling you the reason why I feel that needs to go. Has nothing to do with the center.
Well, I want to know what goes back to public works because we have solid waste in there, too.
Well, solid waste, where does that go?
It's under Environmental Services.
Right. And where did it go before 5 years ago? Well, before the experimental started?
We moved it because it wasn't working where it was.
Well, that's in your mind. That's in your mind. In my mind, I think that things would work better by going through the process that it went through. And my people that I've talked to said that this was an experiment 5 years ago.
No, it wasn't an experiment.
Steve Stewart, a guy, in fact, I met with a guy at noon today, and he told me the whole thing that it was blamed it all on Steve Stewart. You said that you had something to do with it because that's what you got elected from. This guy said Steve Stewart was the big pusher, the guy that did it. I don't know who's right and who's wrong, but what I'm saying in my mind, and I'm a short timer, I think that that it would save the taxpayers a whole lot of money. It would streamline things a lot better, and most of the 99% of the paperwork, Tom, all ends up in Heath Henderson's lap into Marty's lap.
You make a remark like that, and you don't understand what the department even does.
Right. But I'm just telling you the reason I think that.
Before you go on, can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. We have a very competent manager here who knows his staff, and if there's anybody in a qualified position to know how to organize the staff in this county, how to optimize the org chart, how to save grandma money, how to be efficient and smart, he's sitting right here.
And I've expressed that to him, David.
Yes, and so I'm not going to tell him how to organize this. In fact, I encourage him, and we've all along encouraged him to find better ways to do government 2.0. Work smarter. You have the freedom and the encouragement, and we look to his leadership to be able to make these calls, to be able to, hopefully, anytime you have a new leader step into any position, one of the first things they're going to do is say, well, is this the smartest way to run all of the resources under my charge? And that responsibility is his, and the smartest thing we can do is say, Mark, we look to you to make some smart decisions. You have our support. Go at it.
Right. And David, in my mind, when I come on here, I told you guys when I accepted out there, I'm not a person to go along to get along. I'm a person that looks at the big picture and see what is going to benefit the taxpayers the most in the community. From my point of view, I think that it would be the smart thing to do.
I need to share something with you. So I asked Budget Bob about this because you know you said that there's three positions that was added. So I went back to Budget Bob. So when we made this transition to make that, the individuals that we brought into environmental services, we brought them and the money that went that was there to fund them, and the direction that we gave our executive at that time was just move those people over here and whatnot. But what they did, unbeknownst to us, they went back and filled the hole of the person that they took out of each department, and that was where the three people came from. Well, so it wasn't three people to come down here. It's that when we took the environmentals from each of those departments into DES, that they went back and filled that. And you weren't supposed to do that.
Well, what I say, Tom, is that the experiment hasn't worked very well in my mind. And if they did that, then they went around what the wishes of the commissioners were, and maybe that needs to be justified. But like I say, mm-hmm. I'm giving my reasons for why I think that it needs to go back that way. The fee waiver things, I hope that on the 25th, is that the date that we're going to get the report on the fee waivers next Tuesday?
Yeah, it's early in the morning prior to the board hearing.
Okay.
I heard they already leaked out.
Find out what's going on with the fee waivers.
Didn't you get on your computer?
What?
It already leaked out of there. Everybody has it, but you and me.
Don't ask me.
Okay.
All I know is when I was given a copy of something on the 6th that said to respond to it by the 10th. The other thing that I would like to see happen, if all possible, and I know it's in the city and it's the Graymore project down on the river, but I think that it's something that either Jeff Swanson or even the commissioners should probably attend. It has to do with what's going to happen with the waterfront, which affects Clark County immensely. Real Estate Connection presents, and it has this program, and I don't know if you've seen this information or not, but I think it's something that would be extremely important for economic development purposes for the county as to what these people are proposing as people that are doing massive Swabby Williamson, McKay, Espino, Perkins Company, but I would like to see if the possibility that somebody from the county should probably attend this thing and bring back a report to you guys. I think it would be important for the commissioners to go there.
I've got some
free
information on that, actually.
It's free.
I had lunch with Eric Holmes this week. And
yeah, it's free.
I think in 2015 they're going to start construction on five or six buildings.
Right.
You know, the disappointment that I have with that is that they're getting a 20-year waiver on their property tax. And that means the rest of us are going to have to step up and pay that additional cost to the traffic impact.
Fee waivers, traffic impacts? Why do we give up any of that to
anybody? You're not in favor of those, so I mentioned that. And the worst part is that we didn't have a say anything about it, and we're going to lose
15%. Well, you did. You could have went to the county commission meetings like our city council meetings like I did and expressed my opinion. You're allowed to do that just because you're a county commissioner. That doesn't stop you from going to the city council meeting. But I think it's important that the county know what's going on in these programs like that. It's a $510 million project that's going to affect the economy. And so David can say we created 10,000 jobs for the month or whatever it is, or for the 6 months instead of 5,900. I mean, it would give you all of this great big perspective on job creation in Clark County. And even though it's created down on the waterfront, the waterfront is still part of Clark County, I think, according to the maps.
I'm waiting to see their environmental impact.
Yeah,
with
you can look out the window.
Setback.
Yeah.
I wanted to see the setback from the river.
The other thing is, the Korean War veterans have put a mural down here on the wall, a big mural that it's the only one that hasn't had a mural. The Unforgotten War, Korean War. So this mural will be completed, and they're going to dedicate it on June 25th, the same day that the Korean War kicked off. 1950.
That's good work. I've walked past that a number of times.
Beautiful. The guy spent all the time.
They have another Korean monument up there on the Help property next to the Vietnam Memorial helicopter.
I wonder if they're going to.
Yeah, we did a dedication up there.
I know we did get a dedication of a couple flags, but I don't remember.
We have some kind of memorial. I was just curious if we're going to take that and combine it or just do an additional one. It'd be kind of neat because I think it's a stone down there. I was there when we did it, and I don't remember.
Well, this is the railroad trestle. It's not a trestle. It's a concrete wall that holds up the earth underneath the rail line, and you've got World War One, World War Two. You've got Vietnam.
Right. Okay, so it's an addition.
There are two pieces of work, actually. You've got Desert Storm and Desert Shield going up there.
We need
all of them up there except Korea. And Harold Olson, both you guys probably know Harold. He got a special award from the Korean government for his efforts in order to promote veterans, and as the vice admiral for the Korean War Group, and there was part of the ceremony that giving his reward here a couple, two or three weeks ago. Other than that,
that's it.
I'm done.
I want to thank you for accepting the appointment. I still believe that you are the best choice of those that we had. And you mentioned the other day, and I was kidding you about it, but you thought you could Kelly Parker, and I said, yeah, she's better looking too. But I want you to know that.
I doubt that.
And so.
Yeah, I'm a beholder.
You know, and it's always good to have a devil's advocate. But one thing that we always like and we always try to do here is to have an open mind. And we learn a lot. We learn from our staff. We learn from one another. So I personally want to thank you and for stepping up and accepting that, because you didn't have to. And I know that they're long hours. There's a lot of obligations. And I also thought it's great because you understand us more than we ever did before. So.
Well, I told you, Tom, after you did your comments in there, I appreciated what you said. And I appreciated you and David giving me the opportunity to look from the inside out. And there is areas that I'm always going to disagree with, whether you or David or whoever else is in here. Mm-hmm. We're not going to always completely agree, but it gave me a little more insight. And I am going to say, just like I'll say it next Tuesday, that I'm proud to have had the opportunity to work with the staff here at the county. I think that they are a great group of people, the elected officials that are here in the county that I've had the opportunity to work and talk to. I think that they have done a tremendous job, and they ought to be rewarded for the job that they do. And my community that I've lived in most all my life as an 81-year-old, and I was raised basically about three blocks away from here on Railroad Avenue between 13th and 14th Street. It's now called Lincoln Avenue. In a two-story house. And Dave Christensen's family lived about three blocks away that has Christensen Shipyard and a whole lot of good
people. The Christensen family, I used to pay the rent.
Right.
And down there with my trucking company was.
Deliver papers. This was the neighborhood here before these buildings were ever built. There used to be an old school that sat basically right in this hole, and it had one of those great big metal slides from about five stories up, and we'd see which kid was capable enough of getting up that thing.
That was the fire. That's the fire escape. What are you talking about? They did. So, I remember that.
Anyway, that's
they
right.
They used to have fire escapes as a slide.
Climb
yeah.
up that thing. Who was the king of the mountain? If you got up there, nobody else did. Yeah. Then you get a very fast ride down.
All right. David?
I'm good.
Good. Anything else to
share? Sure. This morning, Commissioner Menor and I got to attend the work session, the result of yesterday's hearing on the Fifth Plain Creek Road Atlas changes proposal. One of the things that we did agree on this morning was they talked about the C2B or the C2CB designations.
Mm-hmm.
The CB indicated the addition of the center turn lane, but staff agreed after they looked at the service levels that they were looking at that center turn lane wasn't required.
So what was it, which is
C2CB? So that's C2. Center turn lane and bike lane.
And the other option that we thought
C2B
would be
is just two lanes with a bike lane.
Oh, okay.
So everybody's kind of the consensus was that the C2 with a bike lane would provide more than adequate capacity, and that the additional right of way, which was the issue with the center turn lane, we could do without that. And so that kind of that right of way issue went away. That impact. The other thing that came up as a result of that, kind of associated, is the idea of the proposed road on the arterial atlas, whether to vacate that or not vacate it, but to remove it from the county road atlas or to leave it there.
Like 83rd?
That extends 78th Street across Fifth Plain Creek over to 83rd Avenue, goes through Monet's Gardens, goes through the Hinton property.
Yeah.
And there's an estimate that it would take about $1 million to build the bridge over the Fifth Plain Creek. There was a lot of discussion in our scheduled hour meeting turned into approximately 3 hours because a lot of people want to discuss pros and cons of other alternate proposals and routes, whether to cross the creek or divert that north up to 88th. But what's going to happen is next month the decision is going to come before the board on the 16th, and we tried to shepherd that down and say the question that's going to be put to the board is to keep that on the road atlas or remove it, not to deal with any of the other potential proposals.
That's good.
So I talked to staff afterwards and made sure that they were kind of understood that.
In your meeting today, was our developer attorney there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Randy,
I couldn't think of his name.
Ryan Hurley was there, and Mr. Hinton was there as well.
We had two meetings, and I kept looking for Randy to be there, and he had conflicting things, so I was hoping that in that developer's agreement, they're supposed to be doing all this building up, but if it requires $1 million bridge, I guess they'll pick that up. They actually talked about a developer's fee attached to each piece of property to pay for the development there. So.
Yeah, well, to get that bridge built would require a complicated process. And the question is it necessary to have that or not? There's all kinds of questions around that. So you'll have a presentation on that, and within a month you'll have what the developers recommend, what the citizens.
So we can move on with the other.
Well, the only question will be, do you want to keep that proposed road and bridge on the arterial atlas and keep that as part of the long-range plan, or do you want to remove that as part of the long-range plan? That will be the question you answer next
until
month.
Until we get it worked out, ultimately, we'll probably remove it.
The staff and the stakeholders are all preparing things so that it'll be very, very straightforward, and there'll either be consensus that'll be simple or not, and they'll have that all sorted out. For instance, just taking out that center lane in the road, that was 100% consensus with everybody. It just solves the problem. So hopefully we'll end up with something as simple on the 83rd Street extension.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the developers and the residents, just to give you a feel for it, to them it doesn't make sense to have that there. The cost, it's not on our capital facilities plan in the next 20 years, which means it's not a near-term foreseeable solution.
Yeah.
And they don't feel that it's required for circulation. So there's those issues. Our staff, of course, but naturally they're going to defend. This has been our plan for a while. It's been on the Atlas since 1998. So
therefore,
this has been the plan.
Wasn't it part of the plan?
And we did away with it. Huh?
Yes. And it was there before Monet's Garden
was there.
So they
all agreed to it.
Or the developer did. So So anyway, so that's an issue. Our staff, is prepared to support whatever decision the board makes and recognizes that's within your realm to decide.
This discussion, along with other discussions that you and I have had, have really recognized the need for a policy that we don't have, that recognizes the low impact developments that the Department of Ecology is placing upon our county, that recognizes the significance of the critical shorelines throughout mm-hmm. our county. What we don't have now is something that says, here's the threshold that's defined by some kind of parameters that says, in order for us to go into a critical shoreline like Fifth Plain Creek and violate that, there needs to be some something that justifies it. Otherwise, respect the critical environment, respect that shoreline that's of a high degree, mm-hmm. and that's something over the next several months I hope that we'll be able to work with staff to craft so that we recognize the low impact development where the natural barriers that should be respected occur so that realistic development, cost effective mm-hmm. development that doesn't pay a high environmental price fits. We don't have such a policy.
It would have
now.
Been nice, David, if the developer and real estate people would have told some of the people that they sold the lots to out there that come up here from California that bought the lots and end up finding out that it was dry as a bone until the next winter and all their lower part of their property all flooded out and they had to dig a big ditch and put big drain pipes and stuff in order to get the water off their property. Mm-hmm. So I just got another email from another husband and wife that says that there's a flooding problem out there, and Tom is aware. Tom and I talked about it. There's a low place out there where the water gathers up in. So are we, do the developers have a responsibility, or the real estate people, again, back to Doug, do they have a responsibility to notify somebody that's buying a lot in Monet Gardens, that if you buy that piece of property on the lower end, that in the rainy season, that your lower part of your property is going to flood into your shed, and you have to move everything out of it?
I think what you're talking about is a private sale, and they have to disclose by law. And then we're not selling it as a county.
I know, but the county has a responsibility, Tom. If you're talking about a bridge over Fifth Plain Creek, mm-hmm. my kids used to fish that thing.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. So, but the water problem, there's a water problem in that area.
Absolutely, there is.
Yeah, and the developer that's building a property, in order to be able to sell a lot to somebody, should make sure that they take care of that water problem before they sell it to somebody that spends $500,000 to build a home and a nice garage and stuff and a picnic area in there to find out the next winter that's all going to get flooded out.
They should have never been given the permit there if it was in the buffer. If that's in the buffer,
some of them had buyer's agents when they bought too, and their buyer's agent probably should have informed
right,
the person
right,
that they're representing.
Right.
What you're discussing is a different policy completely. What we're recognizing with our transportation policy and our roads and public mm-hmm. works and planning is that there's no provision right now. There's no policy that recognizes the national geographic barriers within our county. That's the policy that somehow we need to align with low impact development, we need to be able to connect that with our planning for where we put roads and bridges.
But if the road and the bridges go through there, David, maybe the county could do something in order to help mitigate the flooding at Fifth Plain Creek. They've mm-hmm. always had flooding problems out there. I know that to be a fact. Tom does too. Yeah. So why, if the county is going to improve the road system for future development that's going east, why wouldn't the county say to the developer, if you're going to build in here and you're going to do this, you have to pay, not expect the county to pay the $1 million to build the bridge mm-hmm. or to put on causeways or mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it to drain the water out there, like these people had to spend, not only them, their neighbor had to put up money too, so that they spent several thousands of dollars in order to put this drainage ditch through there in order to get rid of the water off the property.
I'm surprised they were allowed to do that. That's against the law to put a drainage ditch in there.
Well,
you can't do that.
Well,
and all that construction, all that road building, and all those bridges are paid by the developer. We don't pay for that.
Yeah. Well, so if this was just a neighborhood, our Clark County Code under the variances for cross-circulation, it allows the county to
grant them a variance and not provide cross circulation where there's topography like this. So if this was not on the arterial atlas, we would not require the developer to cross a significant water body or a significant wetland like this. But when we put something on the county road atlas, when they are looking at potential cross circulation, they are not taking into account the cost to cross something like that as part of their high level view on how they want to address traffic. So I think that's what Commissioner Medora is trying to say, is we need to take that into consideration and consider the topography and the cost to cross those when we do it as a county and put it on that atlas for the major roads.
And I agree, I understand what you're saying, Peter, but I can go out there and show you a map hanging on the wall that's Clark County hanging on the wall. Mm-hmm. There's no barriers like you're talking about. There's nothing marked out at the time. This has all evolved over periods of time where people have said, we have to correct this problem, we have to build a bridge, we have to build a road, we have to do whatever in order to claim the land so that the developer can put million-dollar homes on it, gate them, whatever. So whether the developer's paying for it or not, in the long run, Tom, the taxpayers are paying for it.
Well, Peter, tell me how.
How they're paying for it?
Yeah, the developer is already have to do it. They know they have to do that on this Minet Gardens area. That whole
then
area.
Why is the question? We've already said to them, you're going to do away with the center lane so the road could go up through there.
That's the county making the choice of where the road goes. The developer is going to pay for it.
Well,
We're not subsidizing them. They pay for all of it, for all of us.
And when we have a major road, a circulator road, we tell them what size it's going to be, and it's on our road atlas, so they know ahead of time what kind of right-of-way they're going to have to dedicate and what kind of improvement they'll have
to
make.
But what about all the other roads that are wrapped around that out there, Minet Garden? The developer isn't paying for that or the improvements on them.
No, they actually the ones that we talked about redesignating
right,
to urban circulator roads.
Yeah,
they will pay for all the frontage
east,
improvements
north
on
east,
those.
North and east.
Yeah, if they develop county, adjacent to that,
so the
they improve
gonna have to buy
that,
the
right-of-way
footage.
No, we're not going to buy any additional footage. We're going to keep it the same right-of-way width it is now by keeping it just a two-lane road.
No, I'm talking about the property north and east, and so that they don't have to dig into the property to the south and to the west. Who pays for that?
Well, see, originally that was going to be triggered by us asking for a three-lane road instead of a two-lane road. But we asked them to look at the traffic requirements, and it was so far under the requirement for that they said, no, we only really
talking
need
about
a two-lane
two different
road.
Things.
Yeah. So we don't have to ask for any additional right-of-way.
No matter what. No matter what.
But what I'm saying eventually,
who pays
when
for
it gets developed, these guys, that all that property east is not developed. At some point in time, it's going to be, it's going to have to be improved, just like Ward Road. Ward Road, I can remember when it was wide enough just for a couple buggies to go up and down Ward Road.
When someone
look
goes
at
down
it now,
there,
and who paid for it? The taxpayers.
Yeah. No.
But
no.
We can only project
when
out
they
so
extend
far.
Down on 88 and they do a development down there, that developer will pay for the improvements on 88.
Mm-hmm. On 88, but they're not paying for all the roads to get there.
They will
Tom.
Pay for all the impacts. All the impacts are paid
okay,
for that.
All right.
Well, let me draw a distinction here. 119th,
yep.
We have a big project
right.
there from 72nd to 94th, I believe.
Yep.
All right. The county's paying for all that.
Yep.
Because it's just residential property or farmland yep. on either side, north and south. All right. That road improvement is driven by development miles to the east and miles to the west.
Right.
And we need an arterial there that can
right.
handle the traffic flow that we're beginning to see. All right. But if you have development, frequently developers have to do frontage improvements. They got to put in sidewalks and trees and all this, or build a half road. And then the county will build the half road, or another developer will when the other side of the street develops. So you got different kinds of road requirements. And in some cases, developers pay. In some cases, the county
right.
pays. And in some cases, both pay.
Okay, Mark. Mm-hmm. In order for 119th and the county to pay for that road, the developer knew full well when he went east and put those housing developments in and did it on the west, as sooner or later as he built up that area, that somebody was going to have to pay, and it wasn't going to be him. It was going to be the taxpayers of Clark County that was going to rebuild those roads and that.
But when we were collecting TIF fees, as development occurs, they pay into the TIF funds, and we use those.
We need to do that again.
We use those to improve roads. So, okay, we done with that subject? Well, was that you?
Anything else?
Sorry.
Anything else you want to bring up? Thanks a lot.
No, I'm afraid
I'm not going to ask you again. Axel, do you have anything?
No, it's just there's a lot going on. You could tell by the agenda yesterday.
Yes.
Busy time of year. Everybody's winding up contracts and grants and everything else. Just so you know, last week the Crescent Board did approve the radio contract, which we talked about quite a few times. So that's good moving forward. Taylor was here today. We're really probably the biggest thing for me and him is getting making sure the ambulance stuff is done before the end of the year. So that's moving along pretty well. And what else? We've got the legislative meeting coming up. We started getting RSVPs for that second week of December or something. So that should be always a fun meeting. And we'll have all the materials.
Is that the breakfast at the Hilton followed by the
the
session afterwards?
And is that on our calendar, Anna? The breakfast at the Hilton, the legislative breakfast.
I'm sure it is.
I'm sure it is.
We should be able to.
It's like December 12th, I'm guessing.
I think they put that on there automatically.
I think they did. And then I got to talk to incoming Commissioner Stewart the other day a little bit. She was in, too. Quite a few of us
going
to talk to her. But I think, you know, I think that's kind of one of those always kind of exciting and nerve-wracking things for us is having a new boss and new commissioner. So kind of looking forward to getting to know her better and then making sure, that's always important too, making sure that she has what she needs to be successful and she's comfortable with who everybody is and where to go for information.
And she come in to measure for drapes and barges room.
No, she gets what you get.
She gets the standard package.
That's right.
The question is, I have a question.
Yeah.
Has she chosen a time to be sworn in?
4:00 on the 25th.
Oh, next Tuesday.
What time of day will the certification be?
2:00.
Prior to 4:00.
Okay.
We are certifying in the morning.
So the swear-in will be here
in the hearing room.
And we want to make sure that we're all invited to that.
No, I didn't. Well, I'm gonna leave
she wanted
out.
That to be low-key.
Well, I certainly want to. You're planning to be in there, I take it. Right? So I just want to make sure it's on our schedule.
All right.
Want to make a warm welcome.
Holly, you have
like
anything for us?
Like we did there, Ed.
Is there anything you need to correct us on or set us straight?
No, I got the 2:00 in there. That was
okay.
You got a list.
Mr. Administrator.
Save the best for last, right? I'd like to report, I'm a big fan of online services, and you can now renew your animal license online.
Wonderful.
Isn't that awesome? We talked about that.
That's good.
You know, what that's proving? It's proving that we're getting more people to buy license.
The hope is that this will dramatically, certainly increase revenue. You can apply for a new one. You can renew, manage your pet license accounts, the whole soup to nuts. So, but you do need to put in a login and password and create an account.
Can you send me a link?
I sure can. I'll do that while I'm talking.
Doing what?
Paul Scarpelli asked, and I know why you want the link. I'm not going to send you the link until I get the green light.
Okay, when you're ready, when he's ready.
This is available to the public, and we've been testing it. We did discover one little bug on this side of the firewall that we corrected. So we're beta testing.
Okay.
It is minutes after it went live, they're playing with it, and a woman renewed her license.
Woo!
While they were playing with it, so
great. Well, when you're ready, let me know.
Okay. So anyway, this is great work, and Commissioner Mielke, I might just give you an update on the Surface Pro 3s and the vehicles. We're buying some mounting hardware, so that rather than having to hold it, they can just click it into a mount, and then they can do their work like this.
Yeah.
And we're also going to tie it into the vehicle battery, so that. The thing stays fully charged. Yeah, so if they're out 8 hours, they don't ever have a dead battery. I know you could plug it into the cigarette lighter, but we want a more permanent installation. So I just like to give Paul Scarpelli some kudos for the great stuff he's doing.
Very good.
Lastly, I have a vacancy review, and this is from Budget Bob, and he says if you don't approve this, he's going to quit.
So, okay, we're not going to approve it.
So with that,
what are your comments?
I have a line outside the door looking for his
job. I heard him say me earlier if he didn't get there in place, but he was quitting.
This is Nikki Peterson.
He's got three people out here want his job already.
You know, we already reduced the staff in there 20%, and you know, there's four people in there now. This would be another 25% reduction, and I might just remind the board how smoothly the budget process went this year.
Yes.
And so I strongly recommend that we authorize Bob to hire a replacement.
I've already talked with Bob on this, and his office is doing a fabulous job. And congratulations to Nikki for being there so long and retiring. And certainly support his request to be able to replace that key person.
Yeah, I might add that that Nikki and Bob and this other woman ran the budget office for the city of Gresham over in Portland.
So, is that right?
So Nikki's going to retire, and the other woman that worked with Bob and Gresham, Bob is going to reach out to her to see if he can entice her to come work for us.
Or to at least,
well, encourage her to apply and compete against all the other capable candidates.
I'm sure
we'll attract.
So do the Hallmark thing, care enough to pick the very best?
Correct, yes.
Do we need to make a motion to allow
No, just
consensus, yes.
Yep. We're good to go. And with that, I'm done, sir.
Have I think we're all done, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen and ladies. Have a good evening. Get home.